Hey, this is Hal Hester. I'm the pastor of Vineyard Christian Church, and this is our podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today. I hope this message inspires you, builds your faith, and gives you perspective on how God is moving in your life. Please enjoy the message.
All right. Well, so today we are in Acts chapter 26, and Paul's appearance before King Agrippa. Now, after Paul's second missionary journey, so we've looked at his first and his second journey. After his second journey, he returned to Jerusalem, where he was arrested by the Jews, basically under false pretenses. Now, as the situation gets out of hand, Paul uses his Roman citizenship for only the second time. Keep in mind that the first time we talked about it is whenever he was defending Ephesus. And he mentioned that he was a Roman citizen to get some protection for the church, to get some people to back off. In this case, Paul is going to use his appeal to Caesar in order to be able to actually go to the household of Caesar. Now, if you're not familiar with the appeal to Caesar, it is a Roman legal loophole. Its actual name is the appallito, or the appalletto. Which does not in itself mean that you will actually get to speak to Caesar, although in the first century it was fairly common, especially at this point in time. There was the beginning of appallito was about 25 years long, and during that 25 years, most everyone who appealed to Caesar actually got to stand before Caesar. Not always helpful, to be honest, if you look in terms of the case law there. But in reality, you could, as a Roman citizen, actually get the chance to speak to him. Most likely, what it meant is that you were going to go to the highest authority, to the court of Caesar, and you would be heard out by his court. Now, what is the advantage of that is that although he may or may not be heard directly by the emperor, he would have access to the highest rulers in the land, be able to share the gospel with Caesar's court. So really a powerful moment and an interesting history, little case law kind of segue there. But nonetheless, based on that appeal, here's the problem. There is nothing more the local officials can do for him. They can't help him anyway. They can't intervene in the situation because he must go and be heard in Rome, some 2,500 miles away, which is then going to get complicated. And how do you get him there? How does that all happen? But the decision of these governors and kings, as we look at this text, that they decide to have him come in and speak to them, look, only had one purpose. They were calling on him for their own inquiry. In other words, what happens is that the gospel is now going to the Gentiles. See, remember, you think to yourself, why would we, if we're in this part, focusing on the gospel going to the Gentiles, why are we back in Jerusalem? And the answer is that Paul is getting some doors opened here, that God is using this moment to put Paul in the place of speaking to Gentile kings, rulers and authorities, powers and principalities, all in a really, really amazing way. So while he is and technically a prisoner of Rome, the reality is he's actually the prisoner of Christ. And God's going to use this moment to give Paul an audience with the highest officials in the land. Now, on one hand, that's very cool, right? I mean, he gets to go speak to the emperor's household. He's going to speak before kings. Most of us, at the thought of that, would actually probably quake in our boots. But I want you to think in terms of just how cool that is. I mean, he's going to go speak all the way to the highest courts, to the highest rulers of the land. And so we might look at that and go, wow, that's really neat. Look at how God opened those doors. But I also want us to realize that the process took nearly 3 years of being confined. In other words, his appeal to his citizenship at that moment actually made his life more difficult. Let me put this into perspective for you. How many of you got really sick and tired of being confined for a few months? With relative freedom, right? Keep in mind then, Paul as a Roman citizen, would have comparatively had every right that you and I have. In fact, a lot of our legal system, our idea of freedom comes from the Roman legal system, the protections of citizens and things like that. That's where we get most of our ideas about that. And so Paul, who was free to travel about, free to go about, takes this route and he calls in that moment on this whole thing to be heard out by Caesar. So in the middle of that, Paul making this special kind of appeal for the sake of the gospel, one of the questions I have to ask myself in that moment is, would I be willing to put my freedom on hold for 3 years for the sake of the gospel? What do I actually value the most? Let's take a look, shall we? Acts chapter 26, beginning in verse 1. I'm going to be reading from the New International Version. Please follow along in whatever translation you have. The one in your lap, of course, is my absolute favorite translation. Let's take a look here. Acts 26, beginning in verse 1, and we read these words. Then Agrippa said to Paul, "You have permission to speak for yourself." So Paul motioned with his hand and began his defense. "King Agrippa, I consider myself fortunate to stand before you today as I make my defense against all the accusations of the Jews, and especially so because you were well acquainted with Jewish customs and controversies. Therefore, I beg you to listen to me patiently. The Jewish people all know the way that I have lived ever since I was a child, from the beginning of my life in my own country and also in Jerusalem. They have known me for a long time and can testify, if they are willing, that I have conformed to the strictest sect of our religion, living as a Pharisee. And now it is because of my hope and what God has promised our ancestors that I am on trial today. This is the promise of the 12 tribes are hoping to see fulfilled as they earnestly serve God day and night. King Agrippa, it is because of this hope that the Jews are accusing me. Why should any of you consider it incredible that God raises the dead? I too was convinced that I ought to do all that was possible to oppose the name of Jesus of Nazareth, and that it was just what I did in Jerusalem. On the authority of the chief priest, I put many of the Lord's people in prison, and when they were put to death, I cast my vote against them. Many a time I went from one synagogue to another to have them punished, and I tried to force them to blaspheme. I was so obsessed with persecuting them that I even hunted them down in foreign cities. On one of my journeys, I was going to Damascus with the authority and commission of the chief priest. About noon, King Agrippa, I was on the road, and I saw a light from heaven brighter than the sun blazing around me and my companions, and we all fell to the ground, and I heard a voice say to me in Aramaic, 'Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Is it hard for you to kick against the goads?' Then I asked, 'Who are you, Lord?' 'I am Jesus, whom you were persecuting,' the Lord replied. 'Now get up and stand on your feet. I have appeared to you to appoint you as a servant and as a witness of what you have seen and will see of me. I will rescue you from your own people and from the Gentiles. I am sending you to them to open their eyes and turn them from darkness to light and the power of Satan to God, so that they may receive forgiveness of sins and a place among those who are sanctified by faith in me.' So then, King Agrippa, I was not disobedient to the vision from heaven, first to those in Damascus, and then to those in Jerusalem and in all Judea, and then to the Gentiles. I preach that they should repent and turn to God and demonstrate repentance by their deeds. That is why some Jews seized me in the temple courts and tried to kill me. But God has helped me to this very day, so I stand here and testify to small and great alike. I am saying nothing beyond what the prophets and Moses said would happen. Then that the Messiah would suffer and as the first to rise from the dead would bring the message of light to his own people and to the Gentiles." At this point, Festus interrupted Paul's defense. "You're out of your mind, Paul," Your great learning is driving you insane. I am not insane, most excellent Festus, Paul replied. What I'm saying is true and reasonable. And the king is familiar with these things. I can speak to him freely. I am convinced that none of this has escaped his notice because none of it was done in a corner. King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know that you do. Then Agrippa said to Paul, do you think that in such a short time you should persuade me to be a Christian? Paul replied, short time or long, I pray to God that not only you, but all who are listening to me today become what I am, except for these chains. The king rose, and with him the governor and Bernice and those sitting with them. And after they left their room, they began saying to one another, this man is not doing anything that deserves death or imprisonment. Agrippa said to Festus, this man could have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar. Blessed be the reading of God's holy word. It's true, he could have been set free, but then again, that wasn't the plan. Now, keep in mind, if you will, in all of this, we've jumped from 19 down here to 26, and because so much of the things that were happening, we're trying to wrap up here the whole book. But keep in mind, all this is taking place in Jerusalem. And if you go back to chapter 24, it begins with Governor Felix. Now, I want you to think this way. There was the governor Pilate, right? You'll remember Pilate was the one who actually gave the writ to put Jesus to death. Now, he didn't last very long because of that situation. An insurrection happened shortly after that, and he lost his place and is kind of lost to Jewish history altogether shortly after that. There's then a series of governors. All of them last about 2 to 3 years. It's kind of intriguing how difficult it was. Actually, oftentimes being given the post in Jerusalem was a test, and you would spend either a couple of years there and be promoted, or you would die because of the struggle that they were having in Israel in keeping the peace. So Felix was the first one there in chapter 24. And his predecessor, just before him, the governor was Ventidus Cumanus. What a name, right? Ventidus Cumanus. And he was relieved of duty because of failure to deal with the Jews. So Felix then comes in and he says, well, the reason the last guy lost his job and his life was because he didn't deal well with the Jews. The Jews didn't like him. So Felix comes in and he's making sure the Jews like him. And so he decides that in the midst of listening to what Paul said, he's ready to he's ready to arrest Paul and everything. He didn't expect what Paul would do with that and making the appeal to Caesar. But Felix, nonetheless, wanting to do the Jews a favor, puts him in irons. And then the other part of it is once Paul makes his appeal, he's only too happy to let Paul rot in jail for 2 more years. In other words, he just kind of lost Paul's paperwork. In the midst of government bureaucracy, he's left to rot in the jail. And Paul uses that opportunity to regularly preach the gospel to everyone who was forced to listen to him. They're his prisoner. So it's always up to you, isn't it, how you view those situations when you're put in a situation where you are captive. That captivity, who is actually captive? In this case, it was every guard, every prisoner, every governor. Now, Felix Felix wanted Paul to give him a bribe. He thought surely that Paul eventually would give him money and that make it worth his time to let him go instead of sending the paperwork on to Caesar. At the end of that 2 years, he actually got replaced shockingly because of corruption. I know, you're kind of surprised. He holds Paul for 2 years waiting for a bribe, and then he's removed from office for, of all things, corruption. I don't know how those two things go together. I can't imagine. Anyhow, so he loses his job because of corruption, and this new governor comes in, Festus. And when Festus comes in, Festus goes, I see the mistakes the last two guys made, and I don't want to make either mistake. What do I do here? And so he gets the idea that he will appeal to King Agrippa. Now, who is Agrippa? Agrippa, if he had a last name, would be Herod. Remember when there was King Herod who killed all the children age 2 and under? That's his grandpa. And Herod was one of the most brutal rulers. When you read about his history, the man was absolutely vicious. He was clinically insane. And he was one of the most cunning people you would ever meet. He was a tremendous politician, very cunning. He had a son who challenged his rule, and he killed him. And that son had a grandson who's had a son whose name was Agrippa. The grandson. He murdered his daddy. So you can imagine what the family dynamics are. Now, after that his uncle was king for probably the longest period of time when we read about the Herods. He was kind of a clueless goof. And he was king when Jesus was being tried. And he was just kind of a big party boy. And everybody kind of ignored him. So here we have Agrippa. Now, let me tell you about Agrippa. Because King Herod the Great wanted a good successor, but he didn't want anybody to be more popular or powerful than him, he sent his son, his grandson, to Rome to study and to live in the household of Caesar. He becomes Caesar Tiberius' best bud. At this point, Caesar Tiberius is ruling over all of Rome, and Festus, being no dummy, says, wait a minute, I've got Caesar Tiberius' best friend in town, and he's the Jewish king. So surely he knows what he's talking about. And so he brings him in to listen to this situation. And that's what brings us to this moment now, is where he's trying to figure out, what do I write about this situation? I don't even know. I wasn't here 2 years ago. I don't know what really happened. They've been toying with this guy. He's a Roman citizen. He deserves process. But I don't even know what to write. Could you come and listen in this moment? And that's exactly what happens. And here, in this moment, listen, this is what is so fascinating to me, is that he begins with one gospel for both Jew and Greek. See, one of the biggest reasons I wanted to look at this text is I was narrowing down how the gospel spread through among the Gentiles was to make the point that first and foremost, Paul's message, whether he is speaking to the Greeks at the far ends of the earth, or he's speaking to Jews, or he's speaking to both, Paul's message to both Jew and Greek was always essentially the same. There is one gospel for both Jew and Greek. And in each case, Paul begins with the Old Testament, not with the New Testament, partly because, well, the New Testament wasn't written yet. There are a couple of letters that have been written at this point. The letter to the Corinthians has already been written. The letter to Ephesus is yet to be written, but here we have this situation, and Paul appeals to the Old Testament, because without the Old Testament, the gospel has no meaning. The reality is that the gospel is deeply embedded in the Old Testament, and when you and I just run to the New Testament, we can tell people how to obey the gospel. But actually, you can't explain to them why it's the gospel. There, you have ripped it from all of its context. You've ripped it from all of its history. When people say we're New Testament Christians only, I'm saying, well, then you have no gospel. Because the gospel as Paul preached it, when it was advancing over the earth, when it was conquering kingdoms, when it took down Rome, it did so without an assembled New Testament. Hello? Just a thought. Maybe it might be of great value for you and I to know the Old Testament as Paul did. And so here, Paul begins with the Old Testament, and he's teaching both Jew and Greek so that they understand the foundations of which the gospel is built on. And regardless of whom Paul is speaking to, this is what I love. They always get the whole message. In other words, they don't get a watered-down version for Greeks. Well, you know, Greeks they've never been to church, and so we have a special way of preaching the message to them. No, they get the same full gospel. Well, how about a special Jewish version for the... No, they get the same full version. Everybody gets the same full version. He doesn't water it down, cut it down, edit it, or anything else. They get the whole message of the gospel. That's how it was effective. Now, he begins where they are, right? If he's in Athens, he begins with the story of the unknown God. But quickly, he segues from the account of the unknown God to explaining who this God is. How? By going to the Old Testament and explaining the nature of who God is, so that we understand that the God in the Old Testament and the God in the New Testament are the same God. It's not like God suddenly became a Christian in the New Testament and got nicer or kinder. God has always been merciful. God has always been kind. And that any teaching to the contrary is actually absolutely going against the teaching of the Scripture. Now, in that, he goes through here and he's explaining this whole thing. And as they get the gospel, they don't just get the finish line. They don't just get the salvation message. That's not the gospel. That's part of the gospel. It's not the whole gospel. He gives them the whole gospel, not just the finish line part, so that when they choose to obey, they know who it is that they are obeying. They understand who it is that they are coming into a relationship with. They understand who it is that they're doing life with. They understand what the expectations of that life are. Not just that, I'm free, but now there's an expectation that I live and do life with God, and that's a whole different way of life from a Gentile way of life. It's even a significantly different way of life from the Jewish way of life up to this point, because they become free whether they choose to or not keep the other social part of the code, right? The kosher diet and all those kinds of things, they have the option. Paul, when he's with Gentiles, exercises the option not to. When he's with Jews, he exercises the option to, but he's not required to do so. And so he gives this full message. Now, secondly, what I want you to see is how the gospel then gets to Caesar's household 2,500 miles away from Jerusalem and into the households of the rich and powerful. This is what I love. It's not because Paul was a rock star or a movie star that he got into the imperial palace. Sometimes, you know, there's this fascination in modern Christianity every time that a rock star or a movie star or somebody becomes a follower of Jesus. And we act like, oh, now the gospel has hope to get into the minds and lives and hearts of people around the world, because otherwise, how would it ever get there? Really? I mean, you and I serve the God of the universe. He's King of the universe, not just the planet, of the entire universe. I bet you, and I wouldn't bet you more than I bet you, but I bet you that God could open the doors for you to speak before not only kings of the entire Roman Empire, the largest global empire of the time, one of the largest global empires in all of history, that if he can get Paul... You go, oh, well, Paul's impressive. You know what's impressive about Paul? Do you know what's impressive about Paul? Is his willingness, his availability. That's why Paul gets to do all those things. Whenever God says go, he says yes. Let's see, that's how, when God opens the doors for you, the question is will you say yes, right? I mean, when he brings people into your life, people of influence, people of significance, people who are nobody, the question is that when God invites you into their lives, will you say yes to God? Will you use those opportunities or will you not use those opportunities? And in this particular case, Paul is willing even to put his rights, his whole life on hold for the sake of the gospel. There's an athletic director for an NCAA school. I can't remember his name right now. But he told my friend David Young, he said, I've learned something from my athletes. You can be awesome or you can be comfortable, but you can't be both. You can be awesome or you can be comfortable, but you can't be both. And Paul chooses awesome. He lays down his rights. He lays down his life. And the only time that he really is seizing on them is when they can be employed for the benefit of the gospel. He just simply says, look, nothing in this life, nothing that I can gain as a Roman citizen is worth what can be gained for the sake of the kingdom. And so he literally just lays everything down for the benefit of the gospel. I just find that just one of the most captivating things about Paul, because, you know, oftentimes we are led to believe it's because that he had his PhD from Gamaliel University, you know. Oftentimes we're led to believe it was because of his dynamic personality. But actually, you know, all the witness of history is that he actually had a very kind of grating personality. You know, kind of like me, you know. But the truth is that, see, Paul didn't get there because he was awesome. He got there because God is awesome. And he just said yes whenever God opened a door. Yes, yes, yes. Here, I want you to lay your life down. Yes. Here, I want you to lay down all your economic worth. I want you to lay down everything you have. I want you to lay down your benefits. I want you to lay down your family. I want you to lay down the right to a wife. I want you to lay down the right to life itself. And Paul says, yes, 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 yes. And because of it, the gospel goes all over the world. And then he says, this is such a great thing. Let me take a few people with me. And so he has a company of people going with him, like Timothy and Titus and even John Mark eventually. He has Barnabas and Saul, that go with him. Why? Because Paul, his whole consuming thought is, I want to be in on what God is doing. See, all this other stuff really kind of, it just really comes in second, third, fourth place. Actually, the way he said it to the Philippians was this. He says, you know, that I consider all things rubbish compared to the surpassing glory of knowing Christ. Literally, that word in the text, it's not just like rubbish, like trash. He says, I consider everything else to be crap in comparison. We just translate it nice as rubbish today because we're in a polite society and we don't use words. Actually, if I actually use the word, you'd be like, oh, he said that from the pulpit. He uses the most crass form of poo that there is. You know the word. I consider everything else in life that compared to the surpassing greatness of knowing Christ and making him known. And what it hits me is that how much God wants to use us, you and me, to do awesome. How that he wants his kingdom come, his will to be done on earth as it is in heaven. He wants you and I to have this engaging experience. He wants his kingdom to come so that you and I at one day would be able to look upon his face and there'd be no more pain, no more suffering, no shame, that he wants his will to be done perfectly on the earth. That's what he wants. And then we're going like, well, what if I have to deal with the Antichrist? I don't want to deal with that. What if I have to be uncomfortable? What if I have to give up my rights as a citizen? What if I have to go through hardship, trial, difficulty, or whatever else? You know, that, I mean, we can take our time. I'm just perplexed when people say, well, what if so-and-so is the Antichrist? What if he is? Excuse me, do you have a better plan than God? Do you think that just because you don't want to go through it, that you won't? Let me tell you, if somebody's the Antichrist, the good news is it's almost over. The bad news is it's going to get rough. But if you think that you can vote out the Antichrist, really? I mean, have you thought about the logistics of what you're saying? You know better than Jesus? If that person is the Antichrist, you're going to vote them out? You're going to keep the last coming of Jesus happening by your vote? Really? Can I just tell you that it is the most ridiculous thing that we would think that we could have any say or control over that? So let's quit worrying about whether someone's the Antichrist or the Savior. Because my bet is this, neither. And when he comes, I doubt you'll have a vote. I just want to tell you that. I just want to assure you, you will not have a vote. And God's will be done on the earth whether you participate or not. Right? So fretting about it is not going to help you. What you might want to do is get ready and be in the right relationship with Jesus Christ, regardless of who comes or who doesn't come. Because your forever might be tomorrow, right? You might do what my friend did and pass through an intersection and have your life snatched away in an instant. At 22 years of age. You don't know. So I'd just be ready, right? And so in this, Paul's invited to do awesome, to get to participate in the coming and the opening of the doors for the kingdom. He's getting the opportunity to be a part of something so much bigger than himself and to usher in the very presence of the Lord, so that the early church prayed the prayer over and over again, Maranatha. In Aramaic, it means, Lord, come quickly. Not wait until I get my money out of my 401k. Not wait until I get all my money back from Social Security. No, come, Lord, quickly. Not wait until I get to see my grandchildren grow up and be really awesome. Not wait until somebody gets this job or I get to fly an airplane or I get to complete all these other things. Lord, come quickly. See, you can't do comfortable and awesome. You can be comfortable. But a comfortable is the enemy of awesome. So Paul began with the resurrection as the central tenet of his message to Agrippa, pointing out that it was the central tenet of Judaism, being a Pharisee, and therefore he concluded it was no giant hurdle to believe that God resurrected the dead. He told him how he initially opposed the way. This is the way for all my Mandalorian fans, okay? Until he had a personal encounter with the resurrected Jesus on the road to Damascus, which led him to preaching about the resurrection all over the world to both Jew and Gentile. Paul then concludes, it was with the help of God that he is now standing before them in the courts of power to preach the gospel of Christ and to prove that the gospel is in agreement with all that Moses and the prophets said. That is the good news of the kingdom, and that it's intended not only to go out among the Jews, but also to the Gentiles. And that was enough for Agrippa to ask the question, do you think you can so easily sway me to become a follower of Jesus? And Paul's reply is beautiful, isn't it? Minus these chains, I wish that you would become as I am. I want for everybody in this room to be as I am. Paul got to do awesome. Paul was not comfortable. But he got to speak before kings and emperors. He got to see some of the most amazing signs and wonders. Remember last week, we were reading about some of the just ridiculous signs and wonders. Hankies, really? It's just too far out to even imagine. Not by being or seeking comfortability, but by pursuing the heart and the will of the Lord. And that's how God opened doors to awesome. And then listen, when Paul found himself in places of power, he humbles himself. And this is probably one of the hardest ones for us as Americans. And honored those in authority. Paul's reply to every person in power, to Felix, even as Felix sought a bribe, to Festus, who questioned his sanity, to Agrippa, in every other case, at that point where he is before them, one exception, that being in Ephesus, when the city officials had mistreated him, and he used that as a moment to ply his citizenship in order to protect the young church. But in all other places, Paul spoke respectfully to those in authority because that's what we do, church. In fact, he will write to the Roman church, to the church in Rome, the seat of the power and the corruption and all those other things, the seat of all things that were persecuting the church. He will say to those Christians, Romans chapter 13, beginning in verse 1, let everyone be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, whoever rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers hold no terror for those who do what is right, but only for those who do what is wrong. Do you want to be free from the fear of the one in authority? Then do what is right, and you will not be condemned. For the one in authority is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for rulers do not bear the sword for no reason. They are God's servants, agents of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. Therefore, it is necessary to submit to the authorities, not only because of possible punishment, but also as a matter of conscience. This is also why you pay taxes. For the authorities are God's servants who give their full time to governing. Give to everyone whatever you owe them. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honor, then honor. Can I just remind you that Paul did not just preach it or give lip service to the idea. He actually lived like that. He didn't just preach or give lip service until there was somebody in authority that he no longer liked. Well, that's not who I voted for. Paul lived what he said he believed. And isn't that usually the biggest accusation against the church? Is that we live one way and teach everybody to do differently. Paul lived what he believed. He spoke kindly, truthfully, and transparently, even to those who otherwise didn't seem to deserve it. He acted differently because he actually was different than everyone else around him. Now, I know there's a lot of Christian people out there questioning this verse right now. There's been whole forums I've seen on the internet on, a good friend of mine actually posted and said, I just don't know that I believe this verse anymore. My response is that while history proves that God raised up people and nations to overthrow bad rulers, that before you act, make sure that you have first done everything to fulfill this passage. Because the person you ultimately answer to will not be the authorities, or to me, or to any government. The person you will ultimately answer to for how you respond to your government is God. And that ought to make you take a breath for a moment if you have any understanding of who he is. If not, let me encourage you to go back and read your Old Testament and find out who he is and how he handles those things. Church, we are in a very important hour. How we respond in this moment will tell us a whole lot more about what we believe than anything else that we can espouse, teach, or say. What we do in response to moments like these. And can I tell you that regardless of the moment, politically or socially or anything else, that the main thing is still the main thing, that people would hear and receive the message of the gospel. Not just a finish line faith of salvation, but the life transforming power of the gospel, so that you and I could say with Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, that we knew and did the good, pleasing, and perfect will of God. That's what the transforming power of the gospel does. It doesn't just rescue us so that we could selfishly say, well, I'm not going to hell anymore. He transforms us so that we can do his will in this present life. In other words, his desire is for his kingdom to come now in your life, not just when you get to the sweet by and by. If you don't like his will here now on the earth, let me ask you, what would possibly be appealing about heaven where his will is done all the time, 24/7? I just think that sounds miserable. If you already do not like Jesus, you don't like his ways, you don't like his rules, what would you possibly like about heaven? Just because we strip away some of the other things of the flesh doesn't mean if you don't like his ways that you will like his ways. I think there's a lot of people who are just praying prayers and want nothing to do with him. And I think they're going to be really surprised on Judgment Day. Can I just tell you, his kingdom come, his will be done, means he gets his way every single time. And if you don't like his ways, there's nothing you're going to like about heaven. If you do like his ways, if you do say to yourself, I do want to come into that. Just sometimes it's hard. Sometimes my flesh is fighting these things. Sometimes the situation happens and somebody says or does things and it's difficult. And I get that, right? Because it's difficult for me too, right? But I love his ways. And so I go back to that promise of Romans 12, that if I will allow his transforming power to work in me, if I will commit myself to the renewing of my mind and the renewing of my heart and the renewing of my spirit, that I too, right here in the now, can do his good, pleasing, and perfect will, not just when I get there in the sweet by and by. Hello? All right, let's stand together, shall we? You know, I'm often confronted with the challenges of comfort and awesome. This time of year, can I just say, like, so, you know, I think most of you know I'm a runner and cyclist and all, and I like to compete, and, you know, and so we get to this time of year, the holidays, and the eggnog is out, which may or may not be a weakness. And, you know, when all the holiday goodies and the comfort foods and family is abounding and everybody's together, and I just, you know, like saying no to some of that stuff is absolutely a must if I don't want to feel terrible in January. If I want to be able to race in February, I cannot pack on 20 pounds over the holidays. That just doesn't work. My knees will never forgive me. And so I still have to get up before everyone else in the house and go for the run, so that I can afford to eat that big holiday breakfast with everybody. Now, see, that's a fairly simple thing, But can I just tell you that where I feel most challenged by this text is the simple fact that I love my comfort, don't you? I love my convenience. I like my options. But if you think about it, those things were actually made possible by someone else's sacrifices. Someone thought enough to consider the cost of the greater good and paid that price so that future generations could have it even better. And when you and I consider the tension between comfort and awesome when it comes to the gospel, let's just be honest. The hardest part about spreading the gospel, about making disciples and continuing to disciple people, is that it takes us out of our comfort zone long before we get to the end zone, long before the feeling of awesome comes, long before the victory that you and I have to press in now and lay down our lives in the now so that Maranatha, that his kingdom would come quickly. And so, church, that continues to be that message of the gospel, right? Is that we were not called to come and just see. You know, Jesus said to some of the disciples, come and see. But he finished with, come and go with me to Jerusalem. Come and die. And the apostles, all of them, not really understanding it, they said, yes, let us go to Jerusalem and die. They had no idea what it was really that they were signing up for, how true that statement was. See, not necessarily a physical death for them like it was for Jesus in that moment, but it was the process of dying to self, to let go of all the things that they thought about the kingdom, all the things that they were wanting, all the things that they thought that Jesus would do, and to allow Jesus to do what Jesus does. To not just save the world, but to bring us to himself. And so you and I, that's the toughest call right now, isn't it? For you and I just to trust him, to believe him, that we are safe to put our lives in his hands, to surrender, that we would go to Jerusalem, if you will, that we would go, that we would come and die to ourselves, whatever that looks like, without putting conditions or parameters on that. So as we head into like the merriest of holidays, right? I mean, Thanksgiving. The point of Thanksgiving is for you and I to remember all the good things that God has done for us and to give him thanks. And might the most adequate response be that you and I, for Thanksgiving, that we would truly give thanks by giving him absolute reign over our lives.
I hope you enjoyed the podcast today, and if you did, there's two things I'd love to ask of you. Number one, would you subscribe to our show? That way, the most recent podcast will be in your feed, ready for you when you are. And secondly, if this ministry has impacted you and you'd like to help us continue to reach others, you can click on the link in the description to give now.